Though the discovery of neuronal stem cells was momentous, it is only one of the ways the aging brain can rejuvenate and improve itself. Paradoxically, sometimes losing neurons can improve brain function, as happens in the massive pruning back that occurs during adolescence when synaptic connections and neurons that have not been extensively used die off, in perhaps the most dramatic case of use it or lose it. Keeping unused neurons supplied with blood, oxygen, and energy is wasteful, and getting rid of them keeps the brain more focused and efficient. That we still have some neurogenesis in old age is not to deny that our brains, like our other organs, gradually decline. But even in the midst of this deterioration, the brain undergoes massive plastic reorganization, possibly to adjust for the brain's losses. Researchers Melanie Springer and Cheryl Grady of the University of Toronto have shown that as we age, we tend to perform cognitive activities in different lobes of the brain from those we use when we are young. When Springer and Grady's young subjects, aged 14 to 30 years, did a variety of cognitive tests, brain scans showed that they performed them largely in their temporal lobes, on the sides of the head, and that the more education they'd had, the more they used these lobes. Subjects over 65 years had a different pattern. Brain scans showed that they performed these same cognitive tasks largely in their frontal lobes, and again, the more education they'd had, the more they used the frontal lobes. This shift within the brain is another sign of plasticity. Shifting processing areas from one lobe to another is about as large a migration as a function can make. No one knows for sure why this shift happens, or why so many studies suggest that people with more education seem better protected from mental decline. The most popular theory is that years of education create a cognitive reserve, many more networks devoted to mental activity, that we can call upon as our brains decline. Another major reorganization of the brain occurs as we age. As we have seen, many brain activities are lateralized. Much of speech is a left hemispheric function, while visual spatial processing is a right hemispheric function, a phenomenon called hemispheric asymmetry. But recent research by Duke University's Roberto Cabeza and others shows that some lateralization is lost as we age. Prefrontal activities that took place in one hemisphere now take place in both. While we don't know for sure why this happens, one theory is that as we age and one of our hemispheres starts to become less effective, the other hemisphere compensates, suggesting that the brain restructures itself in response to its own weaknesses. We now know that exercise and mental activity in animals generate and sustain more brain cells, and we have many studies confirming that humans who lead mentally active lives have better brain function. The more education we have, the more socially and physically active we are. And the more we participate in mentally stimulating activities, the less likely we are to get Alzheimer's disease or dementia. Not all activities are equal in this regard. Those that involve genuine concentration, studying a musical instrument, playing board games, reading, and dancing, are associated with a lower risk for dementia. Dancing, which requires learning new moves, is both physically and mentally challenging and requires much concentration. Less intense activities such as bowling, babysitting, and golfing are not associated with a reduced incidence of Alzheimer's. These studies are suggestive, but stop short of proving that we can prevent Alzheimer's disease with brain exercises. These activities are associated with or correlated with less Alzheimer's, but correlations don't prove causality. It is possible that people with very early onset but undetectable Alzheimer's begin slowing down early in life and so stop being active. The most we can say about the relationship between brain exercises and Alzheimer's at the moment is that it seems very promising. As Merzenich's work has shown, however, a condition often confused with Alzheimer's disease and much more common, age-related memory loss, a typical decline in memory that occurs in advanced years, seems almost certainly reversible with the right mental exercises. Though Dr. Kuransky didn't complain of general cognitive decline, he did experience some senior moments, which was part of age-related memory loss, and the benefits he got from the exercises certainly showed he had other reversible cognitive deficits that he hadn't even been aware of. Dr. Kuransky, it turns out, was doing everything right to fight off age-related memory loss, making him an exemplary model for the common practices we should all be pursuing. Physical activity is helpful not only because it creates new neurons, but because the mind is based in the brain, and the brain needs oxygen. Walking, cycling, or cardiovascular exercise strengthens the heart and the blood vessels that supply the brain and helps people who engage in these activities feel mentally sharper, as pointed out by the Roman philosopher Seneca 2,000 years ago. Recent research shows that exercise stimulates the production and release of the neuronal growth factor BDNF, which, as we saw in Chapter 3, Redesigning the Brain, plays a crucial role in effecting plastic change. In fact, whatever keeps the heart and blood vessels fit invigorates the brain, including a healthy diet. A brutal workout is not necessary. Consistent, natural movements of the limbs will do. As von Prague and Gage discovered, simply walking at a good pace stimulates the growth of new neurons. Exercise stimulates your sensory and motor cortices and maintains your brain's balance system. These functions begin to deteriorate as we age, making us prone to falling and becoming housebound. Nothing speeds brain atrophy more than being immobilized in the same environment. The monotony undermines our dopamine and attentional systems, crucial to maintaining brain plasticity. A cognitively rich physical activity, such as learning new dances, will probably help ward off balance problems and have the added benefit of being social, which also preserves brain health. Tai Chi, though it hasn't been studied, requires intense concentration on motor movements and stimulates the brain's balance system. It also has a meditative aspect, which has been proven very effective in lowering stress and so is likely to preserve memory and the hippocampal neurons. Dr. Kuransky is always learning new things, which plays a role in being happy and healthy in old age, according to Dr. George Vaillant, a Harvard psychiatrist who heads up the largest, longest ongoing study of the human life cycle, the Harvard Study of Adult Development. He studied 824 people from their late teens through to old age from three groups: Harvard graduates, poor Bostonians, and women with extremely high IQs. Some of these people, now in their 80s, have been tracked for over six decades. Vaillant concluded that old age is not simply a process of decline and decay, as many younger people think. Older people often develop new skills and are often wiser and more socially adept than they were as younger adults. These elderly people are actually less prone to depression than younger people and usually do not suffer from incapacitating disease until they get their final illness. Of course, challenging mental activities will increase the likelihood that our hippocampal neurons will survive. One approach is to use tested brain exercises, such as those Mrazek developed. But life is for living, and not only for doing exercises, so it is best that people also choose to do something they've always wanted to do, because they will be highly motivated, which is crucial. Mary Fasano, at age 89, earned her undergraduate degree from Harvard. David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, taught himself ancient Greek in old age to master the classics in the original. We might think, what for? Who am I fooling? I'm at the end of the road. But that thinking is a self-fulfilling prophecy, which hastens the mental decline of the use-it-or-lose-it brain. At 90, the architect Frank Lloyd Wright designed the Guggenheim Museum. At 78, Benjamin Franklin invented bifocal spectacles. In studies of creativity, H.C. Lehman and Dean Keith Simonton found that while the ages of 35 to 55 are the peak of creativity in most fields, people in their 60s and 70s, though they work at a slower speed, are as productive as they were in their 20s. When Pablo Casals, the cellist, was 91 years old, he was approached by a student who asked, "Master, why do you continue to practice?" Casals replied, "Because I am making progress." Chapter 11. More Than the Sum of Her Parts. A woman shows us how radically plastic the brain can be. The woman joking with me across the table was born with only half her brain. Something catastrophic happened while she was in her mother's womb, though no one knows what for sure. It wasn't a stroke, because stroke destroys healthy tissue, and Michelle Mack's left hemisphere simply never developed. Her doctors speculated that her left carotid artery, which supplies blood to the left hemisphere, may have become blocked while Michelle was still a fetus, preventing that hemisphere from forming. At birth, the doctors gave her the usual tests and told her mother, Carol, that she was a normal baby. Even today, a neurologist would not likely guess, without a brain scan, that a whole hemisphere is missing. I find myself wondering how many others have lived out their lives with half a brain without themselves or anyone knowing it. I am visiting Michelle to discover how much neuroplastic change is possible in a human being whose brain has undergone such a challenge. But a doctrinaire localizationism, which posits that each hemisphere is genetically hardwired to have its own specialized functions, is itself seriously challenged if Michelle can function with only one. It's hard to imagine a better illustration or indeed a greater test of human neuroplasticity. Though she has only a right hemisphere, Michelle is not a desperate creature barely surviving on life support. She is 29 years old. Her blue eyes peer through thick glasses. She wears blue jeans, sleeps in a blue bedroom, and speaks fairly normally. She holds a part-time job, reads, and enjoys movies and her family. She can do all this because her right hemisphere took over for her left, and such essential mental functions as speech and language move to her right. Her development makes it clear that neuroplasticity is no minor phenomenon operating at the margins. It has allowed her to achieve massive brain reorganization. Michelle's right hemisphere must not only carry out the key functions of the left, but also economize on its own functions. In a normal brain, each hemisphere helps refine the development of the other by sending electrical signals informing its partner of its activities, so the two will function in a coordinated way. In Michelle, the right hemisphere had to evolve without input from the left and learn to live and function on its own. Michelle has some extraordinary calculating skills, savant skills, that she employs at lightning speed. She also has special needs and disabilities. She doesn't like to travel and gets easily lost in unfamiliar surroundings. She has trouble understanding certain kinds of abstract thought. But her inner life is alive, and she reads, prays, and loves. She speaks normally except when frustrated. She adores Carol Burnett comedies. She follows the news and basketball and votes in elections. Her life is a demonstration that the whole is more than the sum of its parts, and that half a brain does not make for half a mind. 140 years ago, Paul Broca opened the era of localizationism, saying, "One speaks with the left hemisphere," and initiated not only localizationism, but the related theory of laterality, which explored the difference between our left and right hemispheres. The left came to be seen as the verbal domain, where such symbolic activities as language and arithmetic calculation took place. The right housed many of our nonverbal functions, including visual spatial activities, as when we look at a map or navigate through space, and more imaginative and artistic activities. Michelle's experience reminds us how ignorant we are about some of the most basic aspects of human brain functions. What happens when the functions of both hemispheres must compete for the same space? What, if anything, must be sacrificed? How much brain is needed for survival? How much brain is required to develop wit, empathy, personal taste, spiritual longing, and subtlety? If we can survive and live without half our brain tissue, why is it there in the first place? And then there is the question, what is it like to be her? I am in Michelle's family's living room in their middle-class house in Falls Church, Virginia, looking at the film of her MRI, illustrating the anatomy of her brain. On the right, I can see the gray convolutions of a normal right hemisphere. On the left, except for a thin, wayward peninsula of gray brain tissue, the minuscule amount of left hemisphere that developed, there is only the deep black that denotes emptiness. Michelle has never looked at the film. She calls this emptiness my cyst, and when she speaks of my cyst or the cyst, it sounds as though it has become substantial for her, an eerie character in a science fiction movie. And indeed, peering at her scan is an eerie experience. When I look at Michelle, I see her whole face, her eyes and smile, and cannot help but project that symmetry backward into the brain behind. The scan is a rude awakening. Michelle's body does show some signs of her missing hemisphere. Her right wrist is bent and a bit twisted, but she can use it. Though normally, almost all the instructions for the right side of the body come from the left hemisphere. Probably she's developed a very thin strand of nerve fibers from the right hemisphere to her right hand. Her left hand is normal, and she's a lefty. When she gets up to walk, I see that a brace supports her right leg. The localizationists showed that everything we see on our right visual field, is processed on the left side of the brain. But because Michelle has no left hemisphere, she has trouble seeing things coming from her right and is blind in the right visual field. Her brothers used to steal her French fries from her right side, but she'd catch them, because what she lacks in vision, she has made up for with supercharged hearing. Her hearing is so acute that she can clearly hear her parents talking in the kitchen when she is upstairs at the other end of the house. This hyperdevelopment of hearing, so common in the totally blind, is another sign of the brain's ability to adjust to a changed situation. But this sensitivity has a cost. In traffic, when a horn blares, she puts her hands over her ears to avoid sensory overload. At church, she escapes the sound of the organ pipes by slipping out the door. School fire drills frightened her because of the noise and confusion. She is also super sensitive to touch. Carol cuts the tags off Michelle's clothing so she won't feel them. It's as though her brain lacks a filter to keep out excess sensation, so Carol often filters for her, protecting her. If Michelle has a second hemisphere, it is her mother. "You know," said Carol, "I was never supposed to have children, so we adopted two, Michelle's older siblings, Bill and Sharon." As often happens, Carol then found she was pregnant with a son, Steve, who was born a healthy child. Carol and her husband, Wally, wanted more children, but again had trouble conceiving. One day, feeling ill with what seemed to be a bout of morning sickness, she ran a pregnancy test, but it was negative. Not quite believing the result, she ran more tests, with a strange result each time. A test strip that changes color within 2 minutes indicates a pregnancy. Each of Carol's tests was negative until 2 minutes and 10 seconds, and then turned positive. In the meantime, Carol was having intermittent spotting and bleeding. She told me, "I went back to the doctor 3 weeks after the pregnancy tests, at which point the doctor said, 'I don't care what the tests have been saying, you are 3 months pregnant.' At the time, we didn't think anything of it, but in hindsight, I am convinced that because of the damage that Michelle had suffered in utero, my body was trying to have a miscarriage. It did not happen." "Thank God it didn't," said Michelle. "Thank goodness you're right," said Carol. Michelle was born November 9, 1973. The first days of her life are a blur for Carol. The day she brought Michelle home from the hospital, Carol's mother, who was living with them, had a stroke. The house was in chaos. As time passed, Carol began noticing problems. Michelle didn't gain weight. She wasn't active and hardly made sounds. She also didn't seem to be tracking moving objects with her eyes. So Carol began what would become an endless series of visits to doctors. The first hint that there might be some kind of brain damage came when Michelle was 6 months old. Carol, thinking Michelle had a problem with her eye muscles, took her to an eye specialist who discovered that both her optic nerves were damaged and very pale, though not totally white, as in people who are blind. He told Carol that Michelle's vision would never be normal. Glasses wouldn't help because her optic nerves, not her lenses, were damaged. Even more upsetting were hints of a serious problem originating in Michelle's brain and causing her optic nerves to waste away. At around the same time, Carol observed that Michelle wasn't turning over and that her right hand was clenched. Tests established that she was hemiplegic, meaning the right half of her body was partially paralyzed. Her twisted right hand resembled that of a person who's had a stroke in the left hemisphere. Most kids start crawling at about 7 months, but Michelle would sit on her bottom and get around by grabbing things with her good arm. Though she didn't fit a clear category, her doctor assigned her a diagnosis of Bear syndrome, so she could get medical care and disability help. Indeed, she did have some symptoms consistent with Bear syndrome: optic atrophy and her neurologically based coordination problems. But Carol and Wally knew the diagnosis was absurd because Bear syndrome is a rare genetic condition, and neither of them showed a trace of it in their families. At 3, Michelle was sent to a facility that treated cerebral palsy, though she didn't have that diagnosis either. When Michelle was in her infancy, the computerized axial tomograph, or CAT scan, had just become available. This sophisticated X-ray takes numerous pictures of the head in cross-section and feeds the images into a computer. Bone is white, brain tissue gray, and body cavities pitch black. Michelle had a CAT scan when she was 6 months old, but early scans had such poor resolution that hers showed only a mush of gray, from which the doctors could draw no conclusions. Carol was devastated by the prospect that her child would never see properly. Then one day, Wally was walking around the dining room while Carol was feeding Michelle breakfast, and Carol noticed that she was tracking him with her eyes. "That cereal hit the ceiling, I was so elated," she says, because it meant Michelle wasn't totally blind, that she had some vision. A few weeks later, when Carol was sitting on the porch with Michelle, a motorcycle came up the street and Michelle followed it with her eyes. Then one day, when Michelle was about a year old, her clenched right arm, which she had always held close to her heart, opened out. When she was about 2, this girl who barely talked started to get interested in language. "I would come home," said Wally, "and she would say, 'ABCs, ABCs.'" Sitting on his lap, she would put her fingers on his lips to feel the vibrations as he spoke. The doctors told Carol that Michelle did not have a learning disability and in fact seemed to have normal intelligence. But at 2, she still couldn't crawl, so Wally, who knew that she loved music, would play her favorite record. And when the song was over, Michelle would cry, "Want it again?" Then Wally would insist she crawl to the record player before he'd play it again. Michelle's overall learning pattern was becoming clear: a significant delay in development, a message from the clinicians to her parents to get used to it, and then somehow Michelle would pull herself out of it. Carol and Wally became more hopeful. In 1977, when Carol was pregnant for the third time with Michelle's brother Jeff, one of her doctors persuaded Carol to arrange another CAT scan for Michelle. He said Carol owed it to her unborn child to try to determine what had happened to Michelle in the womb in order to prevent it from happening again. By now, the resolution of CAT scans had improved radically, and when Carol looked at the new scan, the pictures showed, like night and day, brain and no brain. She was in shock. She told me, "If they had shown me those pictures when we had the CAT scan done at 6 months, I don't think I could have handled it." But at 3.5, Michelle had already shown that her brain could adjust and change, so Carol felt there might be hope. Michelle knows that researchers at the National Institutes of Health, NIH, under the direction of Dr. Jordan Grafman, are studying her. Carol brought Michelle to the NIH because she read an article in the press about neuroplasticity, in which Dr. Grafman contradicted many of the things that she had been told about brain problems. Grafman believed that with help, the brain could often develop and change throughout life, even after injuries. Doctors had told Carol that Michelle would develop mentally only until she was about 12, but she was now already 25. If Dr. Grafman was right, Michelle had lost many years when other treatments might have been tried, a realization that stirred guilt in Carol, but also hope. One of the things Carol and Dr. Grafman worked on together was helping Michelle better understand her condition and better control her feelings. Michelle is disarmingly honest about her emotions. For many years, she said, ever since I was little, whenever I did not get my way, I threw a fit. Last year I got tired of people always thinking that I needed to have my own way, otherwise my cyst would take over. But she adds, ever since last year I have tried to tell my parents that my cyst can handle changes. Though she can repeat Dr. Grafman's explanation that her right hemisphere now handles such left brain activities as speaking, reading, and math, she sometimes speaks of the cyst as though it has substance, as though it were a kind of alien being with a personality and will, rather than an emptiness inside her skull, where a left hemisphere should have been. This paradox displays two tendencies in her thought. She has a superior memory for concrete details, but difficulty with abstract thought. Being concrete has some advantages. Michelle is a great speller and can remember the arrangement of letters on the page, because like many concrete thinkers, she can record events in memory and keep them as fresh and vivid as the moment when she first perceived them. But she can find it difficult to understand a story illustrating an underlying moral, theme, or main point that is not explicitly spelled out, because that involves abstraction. Over and over I encountered examples of Michelle's interpreting symbols concretely. When Carol was talking about how shocked she was to see that second CAT scan with no left hemisphere, I heard a noise. Michelle, who had been listening, started sucking and blowing into the bottle she had been drinking from. "What are you doing?" Carol asked her. "Oh, well, see, I am getting my feelings out in the bottle," said Michelle. It seemed as though she felt that her feelings could be almost literally breathed out into the bottle. I asked Michelle whether her mother's describing the CAT scan was upsetting. "No, see, it's important that this is said, and I'm just keeping my right side in control." An example of Michelle's belief that when she gets upset, her cyst is taking over. At times she uses nonsense words, not so much to communicate as to discharge feelings. She mentioned in passing that she loved doing crosswords and word searches, even while watching TV. "Is it because you want to improve your vocabulary?" I asked. She answered, "Actually, acting bees, acting bees. I do that while I'm watching sitcoms on television, so as not to let my mind get bored." She sang "Acting Bees" out loud, a bit of music inserted into her answer. I asked her to explain. "Utter nonsense. When I am asked things that frustrate me," said Michelle. She often chooses words not so much for their abstract meaning as for their physical quality, their similar rhyming sound, a sign of her concreteness. Once, while scooting out of the car, she erupted singing, "Toopers in your poopers!" She often sings her exclamations aloud in restaurants, and people look at her. Before she started to sing, she would clench her jaw so hard when she was frustrated that she broke her two front teeth, then broke the bridge that replaced them several times. Somehow, singing nonsense helped her break the biting habit. I asked her if singing nonsense words soothed her. "I know your peepers," she sang. "When I sing, my right side is controlling my cyst." "Does it soothe you?" I persisted. "I think so," she said. The nonsense often has a joking quality, as though she is getting one up on the situation by using funny words. But it typically occurs when she senses that her mind is failing her and she cannot understand why. "My right side," she says, "cannot do some of the things that other people's right side can do. I can make simple decisions, but not decisions that require a lot of subjective thinking." That's why she not only likes but loves repetitive activities that might drive others crazy, like data entry. She currently enters and maintains all the data for the roster of 5,000 parishioners at the church where her mother works. On her computer, she shows me one of her favorite pastimes, solitaire. As I watch her, I am amazed at how quickly she can play. At this task, where no subjective assessments are required, she is extremely decisive. Oh, look here! As she squeals with delight, calling out the names of the cards and placing them, she starts singing. I realize that she visualizes the entire deck in her head. She knows the position and identity of each card she has seen, whether it is currently turned over or not. The other repetitive task she enjoys is folding. Each week, with a smile on her face, she folds at lightning speed 1,000 sheets of church flyers in a half hour, using only one hand. Her abstraction problem may well be the dearest price she's paid for having an overcrowded right hemisphere. To get a better sense of her ability with abstractions, I asked her to explain some proverbs. What does "don't cry over spilt milk" mean? It means don't spend your time worrying about one thing. I asked her to tell me more, hoping she might add that it's no use focusing on misfortunes, about which nothing can be done. She started breathing very heavily and singing in an upset voice, "Don't like parties, parties, ooh!" Then she said that she knew one symbolic phrase, "That's the way the ball bounces." She said it meant, "That's the way things are." Next, I asked her to interpret a proverb she hadn't heard. "People in glass houses shouldn't throw stones." Again, she started breathing heavily. Because she goes to church, I asked her about Jesus saying, "Let he who has not sinned cast the first stone," recalling for her the story in which he said it. She sighed and breathed heavily. "I am finding your peas. This is something I really have to think about." I went on to ask her about similarities and differences between objects, a test of abstraction that is not as challenging as interpreting proverbs or allegories, which involves longer sequences of symbols. Similarities and differences work much more closely with the details. Here she performed much faster than most people. "What is similar about a chair and a horse?" Without missing a beat, she said, "They both have four legs and you can sit on them." "And a difference?" "A horse is alive and a chair isn't. And a horse is able to move by itself." I went through a number of these, and she answered all perfectly and at lightning speed. This time there was no nonsense singing. I gave her some arithmetic problems and memory problems, and she answered them perfectly too. She told me that in school arithmetic was always very easy, and she was so good at it that they took her out of her special education class and put her into a regular class. But in eighth grade, when algebra, which is more abstract, was introduced, she found it very hard. The same thing happened in history as well. At first, she shone, but when historical concepts were introduced in eighth grade, she found them hard to grasp. A consistent picture emerged. Her memory for details was excellent. Abstract thinking was a challenge. I began to suspect Michelle was a savant with some extraordinary mental abilities when, in our conversation, almost as an aside, she would unobtrusively but with uncommon accuracy and confidence correct her mother about the date of a particular event. Her mother mentioned a trip to Ireland and asked Michelle when that was. "May of 87, Michelle said immediately. I asked her how she did that. "I remember most things. I think it's more vivid or something." She said her vivid memory goes back 18 years to the mid-1980s. I asked her if she had a formula or rules for figuring out dates, as many savants do. She said she usually remembers the day and the event without calculation, but also knows that the calendar follows a pattern for 6 years and then moves to a 5-year pattern, depending on where leap years occur. Like today is Wednesday, June 4th. 6 years ago, June 4th was also on a Wednesday. "Are there other rules?" I asked. "What was June 4th 3 years ago?" "That was a Sunday then." "Did you use a rule?" I asked. "No, I didn't. I just went back in my memory." Amazed, I asked her if she had ever been fascinated with calendars. She said no, flatly. I asked her if she enjoyed remembering things. "It's just something I do." I asked her a number of dates rapid-fire that I would check later. March 2, 1985. "That was a Saturday." Her answer was immediate and correct. July 17, 1985. "A Wednesday." Immediate and correct. I realized it was harder for me to think of random dates than for her to answer. Because she said that she often could remember days back into the mid-1980s without using a formula, I tried to push her past her recall, and asked her the day of the week for August 22, 1983. This time she took half a minute and was clearly calculating, whispering to herself instead of remembering. August 22, 1983. That was a Tuesday. That was harder because? Because in my mind I only go back to the fall of 1984. That's when I remember things well. She explained she had a clear memory of each day and what happened on it during the period she was in school, and that she used those days as an anchor. August 1985 started on a Thursday, so what I did was go back 2 years. August of 84 started on a Wednesday. Then she said, "I made a boo-boo," and laughed. I said August 22, 1983 was on a Tuesday. It was actually on a Monday. I checked it, and her correction was right. Her calculating speed was dazzling, but more impressive was the vivid way in which she remembered events that had happened throughout the previous 18 years. Sometimes savants have unusual ways of representing experiences. The Russian neuropsychologist Alexander Luria worked with a mnemonist, or memory artist, S., who could memorize long tables of random numbers, and he made his living performing these skills. S. had a photographic memory going all the way back to infancy, and was also a synesthete, so that certain senses, not normally connected, were cross-wired. High-level synesthetes can experience concepts, such as the days of the week, as having colors, which allows them to have particularly vivid experiences and memories. S. associated certain numbers with colors and, like Michelle, often could not get the main point. "There are certain people," I said to Michelle, "who, when they imagine a day of the week, see a color, which makes it more vivid. They might think of Wednesdays as red, Thursdays as blue, Fridays as black." "Oh, oh," she said. I asked her if she had that ability.
This is the end of disc number 8. Please insert disc number 9.